Hi, welcome to episode one of the Eat Better podcast. I'm Chloe Archard and I write the blog Paleo Britain, which has recipes, paleo recipes, products, information on what's going on in the UK in regards to paleo.
And hi, my name's Tommy Wood. I run the blog drragnar.com. I'm a medical doctor and I write a blog about all various aspects of diet and health and fitness and associated things.
So in this first episode, we're going to be talking about dairy because it's one of the questions that comes up all the time in regards to paleo. People seem quite confused. Some people say dairy is okay. Some people say avoid dairy at all costs. So we want to just kind of discuss, answer some questions about dairy. Should everyone avoid it? Is it okay for some people? What's bad? So I'll start off with some questions. Lauren Corday, most of you have probably heard of, he wrote the original book on the paleo diet, called The Paleo Diet, and he says we should avoid dairy completely. So some of the things that he says is that milk in particular causes cancer, heart disease, acne, asthma, allergies, all sorts of things. So what's the deal with that? What's the problem with milk?
So there are a number of potential issues that come up with when people talk about dairy, and I think from an evolutionary standpoint, when people on the paleo diet are talking about dairy, they often bring up the fact that we probably haven't been consuming dairy regularly for longer than about 7,500 years. Some very recent evidence suggests that we weren't able to digest lactose, particularly in European populations, until about 3,000 years ago. So this is something that's very recently become a large part of the diet. And there are so many theories and various mechanisms that people talk about when they're talking about dairy and disease. And I've got just a few of them listed here. The top one is saturated fat. The next one is fat content in general, and then the hormones associated with that. There's also the lactose and the breakdown products of lactose. There's the various types of casein, A1 versus A2 casein, and the fact that A1 casein produces something called beta-casomorphin 7 that we'll talk about a bit later. Then there's also whether pasteurized versus raw milk is better, whether fermented milk is better, and then also whether grass-fed milk is better. So, you know, there's a huge range of things, and everybody seems to have a favorite one. Some people like A1 versus A2 casein. Some people, you know, are still telling us that saturated fat is causing heart disease. I think hopefully everybody who follows this kind of world, the paleo world, will kind of agree that we've hopefully shut most of that door. So depending on the disease and depending on the theories, we can sort of go through all the various different evidence. And the whole idea is that actually I think most of these people, depending on what their theory is behind all these diseases, I think most of them are right in certain cases. So not everybody's wrong. I think almost everybody's actually right. And in the paleo world, there's a lot of mudslinging between experts who all have their favorite ideas. So hopefully we'll try and sift through some of that and see if we can come to some friendlier overall conclusions.
Okay, so if we start with milk, just because milk seems to be something that people do agree on, I don't see very many paleo people saying milk's okay, yeah. Although other dairy products people are a bit more keen on. So what's the problem with milk in particular?
So milk in particular, I guess there are a number of potential problems with that. In terms of just overall looking at the effects of milk on health, one of the studies that's often quoted is the one just came out from Sweden, over 100,000 people looking at both fractures, so bone breaks, which we're often told to drink more milk to reduce our risk of breaking bones, and also just overall deaths. And they saw that as people drank more milk, and they weren't looking at other dairy products, they were just looking at milk, as people drank more milk, they increased their risk of having fractures and they increased their risk of death. So there's obviously something in milk itself that's potentially causing some issues. Overall, if you look at all the studies, though, there isn't a direct correlation between milk and death or fractures. So this doesn't apply to all populations. It doesn't necessarily mean that milk is definitely bad. But there might be something in there. And that's because the milk that we tend to drink has been pasteurized, so it's been heated up to 72 degrees for 15 minutes usually. And what that does is it destroys a lot of the enzymes, and it can denature or change some of the proteins in the milk. So milk often comes with things like lactase to help us break down the sugars in milk. Lactose is the main sugar in milk. And if we heat it up, we destroy those enzymes, so it reduces our ability to digest them. Most milk is homogenized, which involves forcing the milk through very small holes, like a very small sieve at very high pressure. And what that does is it changes the fat globules. The fat globules then get dispersed more evenly throughout the milk, so you don't have the milk rising to the top like you used to if anybody had milk delivered to them back in the day by a milkman. That was unhomogenized milk, but now they disperse evenly because nobody likes that cream floating to the top.
Interestingly, though, I have noticed that more and more supermarkets are starting to sell unhomogenized milk. So I think there must be a demand starting to kind of build up for it, because even like Sainsbury's, Tesco, they do sell unhomogenized milk now. So I think that is something that people have kind of got on board with and are starting to obviously ask for it, because the supermarkets are starting to supply it, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of organic producers that you can regularly get in a supermarket like Rachel's Organic or Yo Valley, they don't tend to homogenize their products, so they're something that people can easily get if it's something that they can afford, obviously.
Okay, so if we talk about just some of the specific things then there that I mentioned, because obviously, as I said, Lauren Cordain sort of blames a lot of things on dairy. So what's the evidence that dairy causes heart disease or is associated with heart disease?
Yeah, so I think it's important to point out that we have no robust evidence that dairy causes any disease. And that's purely just because of the way science works and statistics works. The only way that we'd be able ever to test it is to put some people on a dairy-heavy or milk-heavy diet, some people on a dairy-free diet, and follow them for a long period of time. And that's never going to happen. So all we can do is we can look at trends of consumption across different people, and we can look at their various diseases and outcomes. And that's what people tend to do. So if anybody ever says that milk causes this, they've gone too far, because we have no evidence that milk causes any diseases or any sort of general, particularly chronic lifestyle type diseases. But in terms of heart disease, what we often see is that countries that drink the most dairy or dairy products or most milk, they tend to have higher incidences of cardiovascular disease. And also with that is type 1 diabetes, actually. And there are a number of potential reasons for this. First of all, people are trying to blame it on saturated fat. I think, again, we can just sort of throw that one out the window. But other potential causes are beta-casomorphin 7. So this is a breakdown product of an A1 type of casein. So generally casein...
So casein is one of the proteins in milk.
Yeah, so dairy cow's milk has two main proteins. They're casein and whey.
Yeah.
It's about 80% casein and 20% whey. Yeah. And then casein comes in two different flavors mainly. Beta casein is A1 or A2.
Yeah.
A2 casein is generally found in African and Asian cows, but at some point in the past there was a mutation in European cows and they started to produce something called A1, what we call A1 casein. And it's just a change in one amino acid, but it means that we can't digest a certain fraction. And then what we end up getting is these small peptides. A peptide is a chain of amino acids, a short chain of amino acids. And we get this peptide called beta-casomorphin 7. And there are a number of beta-casomorphins, but number 7 is the one that we really tend to worry about and only seems to come from A1 milk.
Okay.
So there are a number of studies looking at beta-casomorphin 7, and for a while people didn't really believe that we could absorb it from the gut. We know we found it in the gut, but some studies said that we just didn't absorb it. But more recently they've found, particularly in studies with children, that you can find it both in the blood and in the urine. And something that I think we'll come on to later, and you'll have to remind me if we don't, is that I think part of that will have to do with gut permeability. And I think that if you have an increased gut permeability, then you're going to absorb more of these things from the gut. But beta-casomorphin can enter the brain, can enter the spinal cord, can interfere with parts of the gut as well, parts of the immune system. And one of the main things it does is it binds to opioid receptors. So opioid receptors are sort of pain, some of our pain management receptors, and drugs that bind these and block these reduce pain. So these are all the opioids like morphine, heroin, codeine, and beta-casomorphin can bind to these receptors in a similar way. And that
potentially be quite powerful.
It can, and they've shown in rat studies. Obviously, you can't inject beta-casomorphin into a human, but in rat studies, if you inject them with beta-casomorphin 7, you see a reduced respiratory rate, so they start to breathe more slowly. And you can actually, if you give them enough, they'll go into a coma and die, just like you would if you took a heroin or a morphine overdose. And that sounds very scary, but obviously the doses that we're getting from milk are much, much smaller. So I don't think that that's really that much of a risk to us. But it shows that these are it's a very potent protein. So beta-casomorphin 7 can also bind to certain immune cells, so white blood cells, and one of those is called a mast cell. And a mast cell is involved in allergic reactions, or sort of like an immediate immune response. So if you get hay fever or asthma or any kind of allergy, the first response is caused by degranulation of mast cells. And that just means that they release all the stuff that they have inside them. And one of those big things is histamine. And that's why we take antihistamines to control allergies. So beta-casomorphins can cause direct degranulation of mast cells. So they can cause this kind of inflammatory response. So part of the reason people think that milk might be bad for cardiovascular disease is that we know that there's a chronic low-grade inflammation that goes on that affects the arteries, and that's part of the reason why they start to get calcified and we end up getting heart attacks. So in terms of cardiovascular disease, there's certainly a potential that A1 casein could be causing that. The reason why I say A1 casein, both because that produces beta-casomorphin 7, but also because we have quite a few countries that have like the heart disease paradox, you know, one like France, where all they eat is cheese and butter, and they have less heart disease than everybody else. There's also a similar Icelandic paradox where they have a very high dairy consumption, but they don't have as much type 1 diabetes as you'd expect. And that's particularly because Icelandic and French cows produce a lot more A2 casein than A1 casein. So that's a potential reason there.
It's interesting as well because the Western price, all the Western price stuff, they're big into dairy, obviously. And having read Western Price's book, there were traditional societies that did eat a really dairy heavy diet. I know you said like the studies necessarily wouldn't be done because we wouldn't be getting people, but actually he did find people that were eating mainly just dairy and they were really healthy. Yeah. So I know that's his work is not sort of, there weren't studies done on these people to really see what was the rate of heart disease or cancer, etc. But he did find these people that were eating a lot of dairy that were healthy, but maybe they were eating the A2 type.
So the one that people talk about a lot, so one of the big proponents of an A2 versus A1 type dairy is a guy called Keith Woodford. He's a professor of farming in New Zealand, and he has a blog where he talks about this a lot. He also has a book. And one of the tribes or traditional diets he talks about is the Maasai, which are obviously a nomadic tribe in Africa. And a lot of their food comes from cattle and from dairy. And the Maasai cattle tend to produce more A2. They aren't in those groups of cattle that had the mutation in the gene. They consume a lot of dairy and they don't really have any heart disease. But one of the main, I think, or a few confounding factors there is the fact that Maasai cattle are also grass-fed. The milk isn't pasteurized, the milk isn't homogenized, and they often have fermented dairy. So there's a lot of potential reasons why that might be the case, and it might not just be the A2 that's causing the problems. And there are also things like if you compare Finland and Sweden, they have very similar proportions of A1 and A2 casein in their milk. but Finland has a much higher rate of heart attacks. And actually, interestingly, Finland is the one is one of the countries where they actually reduced intake of saturated fat in the population, and they saw an improvement in heart disease. So there's so many things going on that I just don't think that we can just point it at one factor.
One thing. It is interesting, the sort of allergy thing, because when I was a baby, I couldn't have milk. My mum tried me on cow's milk, I don't know what age, maybe about a year, I think. And I came up immediately in a rash all over my body. So the doctor said, keep me off milk, which she did for a couple more years. And gradually I sort of grew out of the allergy. But I still, when I do drink milk, get really sort of allergic rhinitis. I get a really runny nose. I'm going around with tissues the whole time. And when I cut dairy out, sort of switching to a paleo diet, that completely cleared up. Whereas before I'd always sort of suffered from that. And obviously that's just anecdotal, but... It's one of those things that's interesting when you sort of think about this allergic response.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that could be a casein intolerance that you have. It could be a lactose intolerance. Another one of the things, one of the theories behind why milk particularly, which has a much higher lactose content than, say, fermented dairy, might cause problems is D-galactose. So lactose consists of two sugars, glucose and galactose. Glucose people will be familiar with, but galactose is very similar, but you only really tend to find it in lactose. And galactose, if you give it to numbers of animal models, it increases inflammation and it increases aging, actually. They age more rapidly. So if people have, say, an allergic rhinitis, they have runny nose, itchy eyes after drinking dairy products, it could be any one of those things. It could be a lactose intolerance, it could be a casein intolerance, or it could just be the fact that galactose is actually causing more of an inflammatory response in them, and that's what you're seeing there. So there's a number of potential theories, and again, it's not something that we've managed to pin down exactly.
And again, like you were saying before, it comes down to the individual, because some people are going to have that response and other people aren't.
Yeah.
Another thing that's quite interesting is the link between dairy and acne. That's been brought up quite a lot. And I know, again, it's anecdotal, but a lot of people that switch to a paleo diet say, oh, my skin really cleared up and I've suffered from, you know, I've had bad skin for years and I never knew what was causing it.
Yeah.
Is there any sort of truth in dairy and acne?
Yeah, so they've done a couple of small studies looking at dairy and acne, and there seems to be at least a good correlation between dairy consumption and acne, and then acne symptoms clearing up as people start to take dairy out of the diet. And I think the main reason behind that is the hormonal effect that particularly milk can have. Milk is very good at increasing insulin in the blood, more so than you'd expect for the amount of carbohydrate that it contains, and it also increases IGF-1, which is a growth factor. And between them, those two, insulin and IGF-1, are thought to be behind acne and sort of driving the process of creating acne. So if you're taking out those, I think milk in particular is going to be the problem there because of the effect that it has on insulin, but I know a lot of people who have gone on a paleo diet and, you know, however long, you know, a few weeks later have suddenly been really surprised that their skin has cleared up, when that's not necessarily something that they're looking for. And I think removing milk in particular is going to be part of that.
Okay. Maybe let's talk about some of the other dairy products and other than milk, because okay. As I said, milk's kind of quite accepted as being out.
Yeah.
But then some people say no dairy products at all, and some people say, yeah, eat butter, butter's great, eat lots of butter, eat kefir. So what's going on with those other dairy products, considering they are made from milk?
So I think there's two or three things going on there. So if you're going, so say if we look at butter versus other things, butter has become this health food in the paleo community recently, and I'm here in Norway. I have grass-fed, slightly fermented butter, which I'm convinced is doing me good. The more I eat it, so that really does. But it really does depend on. Probably depends on where you're getting your butter from. However, if you're lactose intolerant, so up to 80% of people of an African or Asian descent are lactose intolerant, and probably 1 to 20% of people of a Caucasian descent or European descent will have some amount of lactose intolerance. So obviously there isn't much lactose in butter because you've taken out you've taken that stuff out. There's a small amount of protein, a small amount of lactose, but you can get rid of those if you make something like ghee. Yeah. So what is ghee?
Because I always get questions. People always ask me, what's ghee?
So ghee is essentially just, if you've ever melted butter and you see, you'll usually get some white stuff floating on the top and then some white stuff that sinks to the bottom. And the stuff on the top and the stuff at the bottom are just the protein. So it's whatever casein and maybe a little bit of lactose that you have left, and they separate out. So what you can do is you just melt the butter and you pour it through something, just like a muslin cloth or something, and then that's a very easy way to make your own ghee. You don't need to necessarily buy ghee. You can do it that way. So ghee is just butter where you've taken out the proteins and the sugars.
So it's easy to do yourself, because ghee is really expensive actually to buy if you're going for the good quality stuff. I mean, you can buy cheap ghee, which I think they use in Indian restaurants and things for cooking in, and you can buy big tubs of it really cheaply. But if you want the actual sort of organic grass-fed ghee, it's like 20 quid for a small jar.
And you can buy a stick of Kerrygold and make it yourself for no money. And an important thing to point out is that when they're making industrial ghee, you know, they can be heating this butter to really high temperatures, and actually when you're heating cholesterol containing fats to very high temperatures, you can oxidize that cholesterol, and that's probably not a good thing. So if you're making ghee at home on a gentle heat, I'd say that's probably much better than buying like a big vat of like industrial cooking ghee from somewhere.
And the resulting thing, is it 100% fat?
Pretty much. Various different kinds of fat, yeah.
Okay, fine. Back to why that's good. Ghee and butter work. So they're good because they don't contain very much. Well, ghee doesn't contain any lactose or casein, so you've removed the problematic compounds.
Yeah.
Why is what's left good? Why is the fat good?
So I think we're seeing more and more now that saturated fat is actually a really essential part of the diet. And butter is usually 50, 60, 70, 80% saturated fat, depending on where you get it from. It's usually less saturated fat if you get it from a grass-fed source versus a grain-fed source. But I don't think that's necessarily a problem. And saturated fat is really important for good cholesterol synthesis. And you know, we need cholesterol to make the membranes in our brain, all our cell membranes. And we need them to make vitamin D and all our sex hormones. So people who aren't getting enough saturated fat, they can see a drop in sex hormones, testosterone, estrogen, and they can have problems there. So it's a good source of saturated fat, and it can be a good source of vitamins. Particularly, we talk a lot about vitamin D. There's a small amount of vitamin D in butter. There's also vitamin K2, but generally only in grass-fed butter, we think, because it comes from the K2 and the K1, vitamin K1, that you find in vegetables and plants. And so the cows need to eat grass, and then they convert the K1 to K2.
And an interesting thing, one of the Western Price things is that, again, as I said, they're massive on dairy, but Western Price found that butter, he analysed like 20,000 samples of butter, I think it was, from all over the world, and he found that particularly the summer butter, where the cows were eating only grass, was much higher in K2.
Absolutely.
So I often tell people, buy butter in the summer and freeze it if you've got a big enough freezer, because then you can eat that butter in the winter and it will have higher levels of K2 than possibly if the cows are grain-fed in the winter.
Yeah, but there are some, you know, there are many... many companies, I think particularly Kerrygold, I have no link to them anyway, but I know that they tend to feed their cattle dried grass during the winter, or at least mostly dried grass. And although they won't have as much K1 and won't produce as much K2, I think it will be much higher than a sort of
grain fed.
Yeah, absolutely. So.
Okay, and so then onto fermented dairy. You mentioned the butter you eat is slightly fermented. What about things like yogurt and kefir that are from fermented milk?
So if you look at, there are a number of studies recently, and to go slightly backwards back to the high fat thing, which I didn't mention, is that if you look, there were a number of studies coming out recently that high fat dairy products, particularly not low fat, but high fat dairy products, are protective against a number of diseases, and that's cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes. So I think the dairy fat there is actually really important and may be protective for a number of those reasons. And it might be that we're just getting enough K2 in that dairy fat, even if it's a small amount, to then protect us from diseases like heart disease.
You should be eating low-fat dairy, should they?
No.
You eat dairy, it should never be low-fat.
Never eat low-fat. Like, just throw it away. It's a complete waste of time. All the good stuff is in the fat. Absolutely. I like to say that everybody's right about dairy except for the people who are telling you to drink skim milk, because there's no evidence to support that as being a good idea. So when you get onto fermented dairy, what you find is that the bacteria or the fungi the yeast that ferment the dairy, they eat up a lot of the lactose and might leave no lactose left. But then they can also metabolize some of the proteins and change the shape of the proteins, the shape of the casein, so they might become less problematic again.
Yeah, I read about kefir that the bacteria and the yeast pre-digest some of the proteins. Yep. So then the protein you're getting is already broken up.
Yep.
And some studies show that kind of infants and people with kind of compromised digestive systems can still tolerate kefir.
Yeah. And so you get from kefir, not only do you get a probiotic effect from having some of the good bacteria in there, you also get the fact that the lactose has been broken down, the casein may have been changed. So there's a number of potential benefits there. And if you look at cheeses, yogurts, kefir, fermented dairy products, in almost all the studies where they've looked at consumption, they see a reduced risk of a lot of cancers, cardiovascular disease, again, type 2 diabetes, these metabolic problems that we're seeing. So that could be a probiotic effect, as well as the fact that they've removed some of the problematic parts. And then when you ferment it, you usually increase the amount of vitamin D, because obviously you've concentrated down the amount of milk that you've used, and more K2, because the bacteria produce K2 during fermentation. So all those reasons mean that fermented dairy is probably protective, particularly high fat fermented dairy like cheese and kefir can be protective against a number of diseases.
And yogurt, would you say that's good as well, or is that a bit higher in lactose?
Yeah,
or?
So yogurt is a bit of a grey area. It normally has a far fewer strains of bacteria in there, and Some people find a benefit from yogurt and they don't react to it like they would to milk, and some people don't. So I think that that's really a personal thing, actually. But if you find that you can include yogurt and you don't get any symptoms or any problems, then if it, high fat, good quality yogurt, I don't see any issue with people consuming that.
Okay. So I mentioned already a couple of times Weston Price. I am a big fan of sort of the work that Weston Price did, but I do think that sometimes the Weston Price Foundation sort of push, so basically they say that we should all be eating loads of dairy.
Yeah.
Raw milk is their big thing, and they say everybody should eat raw milk, drink raw milk, products from raw milk, it should be in our diet every day.
Yeah.
Is there any evidence that actually raw milk is this kind of superfood, or really is pasteurized milk?
So it's kind of... So a lot of the evidence behind that is anecdotal, like you say. So a lot of the traditional cultures that Weston A. Price, for instance, found, they were drinking unpasteurized milk and obviously weren't getting any problems from their dairy intake. And then a lot, if people are buying raw milk, those cows often tend to be organic. They tend to be, better looked after. So there's better animal welfare there. That's another reason why people support raw milk. But in terms of actually directly comparing raw milk and pasteurized milk, I don't think there's that much evidence out there. I think people might be able to digest raw milk better because there are some natural enzymes in there. And obviously when we're heating stuff up and processing it, we're never really sure what's happening to the proteins and the fats and things. So again, it's a very theoretical issue, and I don't really think it's been resolved. A lot of people prefer raw dairy just because... it makes more sense to them from both like an evolutionary and an animal welfare type picture. And, I think that makes perfect sense. But I don't think the evidence is that massive in favor of raw dairy. And actually, you have to remember that eating raw dairy is associated with some with some problems. So, you know, raw cheeses, unpasteurized cheeses. Again, these are really popular in France. Maybe that is actually part of the reason why the French don't see any problems with eating high fat, so much high fat dairy, because it's often not pasteurized. But you can get infections, you know, like listeria and things like that. So drinking large amounts of raw dairy could potentially put you at risk of some diseases. Again, you know, the evidence isn't massive either way.
I live near a farm. Just down the road from me is an amazing organic biodynamic farm. They produce raw dairy, they have raw milk on the farm, and you can go down, you can watch the cows being milked, and the milk's brought straight into the shop and you can buy it. Yeah. And I like it because it is so unprocessed. You know, it is a natural food that's unprocessed. Yeah. But very recently they had their raw milk license taken away because there was a TB scare. Yeah. And suddenly I thought, why the hell am I buying raw dairy if I'm putting myself or my family at risk of TB? So that actually has been resolved now, and they put a couple of cows down, they did post-mortems, they found there was no TB in those cows, and they've now got their raw milk license back. But it does sort of highlight that there are other issues around, and that is why we pasteurise.
No, that is, you know, so it's an interesting thing there, because we pasteurise dairy to make it so that more people can consume it, and maybe that's why pasteurization is such a bad thing, because it's allowed us to consume so much dairy. And that's actually that's not my idea. I got that from, I was discussing this with Owen Raybould, who was another presenter at Health Unplugged, and we talked a bit about dairy then, and one of his main issues with dairy is, or the pasteurization processes, is the fact that it's allowed us to consume so much dairy, and maybe that is part of the problem too. But I'm not really sure there's a huge amount of evidence that the act of pasteurization changes milk from something that's incredibly beneficial to something that's really bad. I don't think that evidence exists.
Okay. Another thing, talking about, the Western price stuff, is they say kids should be drinking lots of milk, it helps them grow. And I did read somewhere that because traditionally children would have always been breastfed at least till two, sometimes till four, There is an argument for them having milk because it contains growth factors that actually they might need that they're not getting, because nowadays people breastfeed till 6 months and then give up or don't breastfeed at all. And is there any truth in that? Should kids be drinking milk?
That's a tough one. I think a lot of that is probably, I don't really go in for a lot of conspiracy theories, but that's probably pushed by people sort of producing baby formulas and stuff and saying that, you know, formula as a follow-on from breastfeeding or instead of breastfeeding is the way to go, because they can add lots of vitamins and stuff and say that it's better. It's interesting that actually if you look at growth rate charts of babies that are formula fed versus ones that are breastfed, the breastfed babies actually grow more slowly to begin with, but then eventually they catch up and be completely normal.
Is that even if they're only breastfed till 6 months?
So that's up until 4 months, and then for the rest of the next year. So I think if you look at the growth charts that we're often, or people are often given, are often based on largely formula-fed babies. So people are often told that, you know, their baby isn't growing maybe as fast as it should, and then they should switch to formula and get more formula. But actually, the World Health Organization has a growth chart that's based on sort of whole world populations. A lot of them are mainly breastfed, and you can see they have a slower growth rate, but that doesn't cause any problems in the long term. So I don't think that you need to be like forcing down cow's milk just because the hormones are a good thing. I don't think. That seems like a slightly counterintuitive thing to me. And, you know, there are some good books about how to feed your baby. There's one by Chris Kresser. There's one by Dave and Lana Asprey. And you can get very healthy babies just from breastfeeding for as long as you're able to. We know that breastfeeding is optimal if you can do it. And then there are other ways to follow on. So I don't think you need to be giving cow's milk just to get your babies to grow faster.
And we've talked about this in the past. You have some concerns about formula or cow's milk for babies anyway.
So this is another issue that somebody brought up as a question on your website, and I've read about a little bit before, and it's the risk of cow's milk, particularly A1 casein, the beta-casomorphin 7 that it produces, and then sudden infant death syndrome. So This is something, again, that Keith Woodford brings up on his website. And there are some studies that show in babies that had sudden infant death syndrome, they had more beta-casomorphin 7 in their cerebral spinal fluid. And then a much more recent study looked at babies who had some kind of life-threatening event. So they stopped breathing for some reason and then were resuscitated afterwards. So these are not kids, not babies that died, but were probably at a risk of dying, because about 10% of those babies who do have a life-threatening event like that, they die of sudden infant death syndrome. So this is a relatively small study, but they looked at the amount of beta-casomorphin 7 in the blood of these babies, and they saw that the beta-casomorphin was slightly higher in babies that had these life-threatening events compared to normal controls. But actually, the really big deciding factor there was a level of an enzyme in the blood called dipeptidylpeptidase 4. And this is actually a protein, an enzyme that we naturally have that can break down beta-casomorphin 7 once it's in the body. And actually, all the babies that had an acute life-threatening event, they had lower activities of this enzyme regardless of what they were being fed. So you can get normal healthy babies will have some beta-casomorphin 7 levels in their blood.
Where does it come from?
So this is a good question. And everybody says that all the casein in mothers, like human breast milk, is the A2 type. And I spent a couple of hours early on today trying to look for the scientific reference that says this, like somebody who studied this. And if anybody can find it, I would love to get it, because, everywhere says this. Every blog that talks about A1 versus A2 casein, every blog that talks about mother's milk being best, they mention that all the casein is A2. And I just can't find the study that looked at this. So I'm not saying that it's not true. I'm just saying I can't find the evidence. So it could be that some of the mother's milk casein is naturally turned to beta-casomorphin 7 and we just don't digest all of it, regardless of the casein type. Some people say that it's actually the casein from the dairy the mother is eating is being turned into beta-casomorphin 7 and then is coming out in the breast milk. So it could be that too. And I just don't know. I don't think anybody knows. But what's interesting is that rather than the beta-casomorphin 7 level in the blood being the main risk factor for these babies having problems with their breathing, if you remember, I said that anything that attaches to these opioid receptors like morphine or heroin or beta-casomorphin 7 can reduce your breathing rate and lead you to stop breathing if you have enough. So that's if you get a high enough dose. So that's why they think beta-casomorphin 7 might be bad for babies. But it wasn't the level of the beta-casomorphin 7, it was having low activity of this enzyme, dipeptidylpeptidase 4. So it might actually be that having a low level of this enzyme, regardless of how what kind of milk you're being fed, it might be the mutation that's putting you at risk, and not actually the beta-casomorphin 7 itself. And we don't know where that's coming from. So, if mums...
Also interesting that if the beta-casomorphin is not coming from the mother's milk, then why do we have this enzyme to digest beta-casomorphin? And so, is that an adaptation to eating dairy?
If
it's the mother's milk, then why have we got that enzyme?
So we have a lot of enzymes throughout the body that are basically just there to break down stuff that's where it shouldn't be. So we have something, so like, for instance, the one I can think of off the top of my head is we have one of the neurotransmitters between nerves. One of the main ones is called acetylcholine. And that's broken down every time we fire a nerve signal by something called acetylcholine esterase. But we have something elsewhere in the body called butyrylcholine esterase, which is basically just there to mop up acetylcholine that gets away from where it should normally be. So I think dipeptidylpeptidase 4 is there to break up, peptides floating around in the blood or where they shouldn't be peripherally. So I don't think it's just...
It's not an adaptation to dairy.
Not, at least I've seen no evidence of that. And so one of the important things is that there might be a very, very small risk of cow's milk causing sudden infant death syndrome. But I just wanted to go through some of the other risk factors of that. And most of this work has actually been done by a guy called Professor Peter Fleming at the University of Bristol. And he actually just got an award from the Queen's Anniversary Prize, for his work. And he's basically saved thousands, hundreds of thousands of babies' lives over the years. From his work, they managed to reduce sudden infant death syndrome by over 80% in the UK through various things. And those risks are sleeping on your front, sleeping in a bed with your parents, being in a smoky environment, so people smoking in the house, passive smoking, and then also getting too hot. I think people always worry that babies are getting too cold, and they really wrap them up. And so I'm doing a PhD at the moment, and a lot of my research is into cooling of babies, particularly sick babies. And babies are okay, you know, they have a lot of adaptations to keep them warm if they get cold. So, you know, you don't need to worry so much. All these hats and gloves and loads of blankets and stuff, I think they're actually a big risk factor for sudden infant death syndrome, and probably more so than cow's milk is.
I've got a friend, so obviously I've got two kids, and I've always been told by the health visitors and midwives, don't put them on their front, don't let them sleep in the bed with you. Yeah. But I do have a friend that says, what a load of rubbish, obviously babies would have slept in next to their parents.
No, that's true, but if you think about...
This is nothing to do with dairy.
Yeah, but seeing as we brought it up, if you think about... So again, if we go from an evolutionary standpoint, a baby is born, it comes out kind of wet and covered in goo and all that stuff, and you kind of give it a wipe, and then you cuddle it, right? And you do this wherever, if it's in your hut hundreds of thousands of years ago, your cave millions of years ago, whatever, that's how it would be. They did not climb into a bed surrounded by a huge duvet and pillows and all this stuff. And I think all of that is a big risk factor. And babies naturally are cold for the first 3 or 4 days of life. And that's, as far as we can tell, that's a good thing rather than a bad thing. So people shouldn't really worry about that too much.
Okay. But what's your advice on sleeping in a bed with your baby? Don't do it if it involves duvets.
No, if you want to nap with your baby and all of that, I don't think there's anything, you know, any real problem there. But you really have to check that the baby's not sort of sat up in a funny way so they're slumped.
Yeah.
And in a bed with loads of duvets and pillows is probably a bad idea. And that's another thing, you know, your baby sort of falling asleep in a funny position is another potential risk factor. So I'd go, if you know, on the NHS website, they have a list of all of these. And I'd say that these are probably still the main causes of sudden infant death syndrome rather than cow's milk. Okay. Because I did a quick calculation. The last data I could find was from 2010, which showed that we had over 700,000 live births, and by 6 months, 88% of them had been fed a cow's milk-based formula. And so that's, you know, well over 600,000 babies a year being fed cow's milk formula, and there were fewer than 300 cases of sudden infant death syndrome that year. So even if cow's milk is the singular cause, which we know it's not, of sudden infant death syndrome, then the risk is still very low.
Okay. So just a couple more questions before we finish off then. So how would someone know if dairy is causing a problem for them? We've said that milk's maybe not a great idea for people, but other sort of fermented dairy products could be a really beneficial thing. But how would you know if that's for you or not?
So, I mean, all the typical symptoms you get of some kind of intolerance are worth looking out for. So lactose intolerance, you get, you know, bloating, diarrhea, gas, discomfort. Those are the typical ones. You can get similar things with casein intolerance, but you might get more of like a real allergic type reaction. So skin rashes, eczema, sneezing, runny nose, runny eyes.
People would probably know if they're actually intolerant or like have an allergic response, wouldn't they? Because the thing is, a lot of people switch to paleo having had dairy their whole life with no problem and feel better when they take it away. Is that just enough to tell you that it's not great for you because you feel better, or do you reintroduce it?
I would always, if you have any of those kind of really... you know, people have a lot of vague symptoms, you know, they're tired or they have some rashes or they have some pain. Those are the things that often clear up on a paleo diet. And we just don't have good reasons for that yet. You know, we have lots of theories and lots of the theories are very good, but we don't have true, concrete, 100% reasons for that. So if you do have a lot of allergies, if you have a lot of skin problems or you just feel tired, you don't feel great, then that's a very good reason to say take all these things out of the diet. But I'm a big fan of adding stuff back in and then just seeing how it affects you. So if you take, you know, all your grains and dairy out of the diet and then one day you decide to add back milk for a few days and see how you feel, then, you know, taking the time to really test yourself and see how you respond to these foods is really the only way that everybody can sort of really check how they respond to foods like this. So if they don't have any overt allergy symptoms, but they're still not sure they feel 100%, then that's the way to do it.
And what sort of length of time should people take these things out before they try reintroducing them again?
So for like a typical allergy type syndrome, you can usually see the difference within a few days. But say you've got some problem with, we talk a lot now in the paleo community about a leaky gut and all these kind of systemic problems, then it can really take weeks for that to get better. So 4, 6, 8 weeks, 3 months, it might take at least that long. And if you've got some kind of chronic autoimmune disease or something, it could take, you know, years. And that's, you know, and maybe that's a slightly disheartening fact, but
Valentine, who wrote The Paleo Approach, which is kind of the sort of go-to resource for autoimmune disease, she says these things, you might have to eliminate them for years before you can tolerate them again.
Alongside, you know, that's absolutely true, and I agree with that completely, but alongside that is the fact that if you eliminate foods for a very, very long time, then you're more likely to be intolerant than when you bring them back in. So there's definitely a balance to be had there.
Yeah, okay. So your recommendations for dairy then, for sort of the average person, most people coming, so I know a lot of people do come to paleo with digestive issues and autoimmune, so maybe what would you recommend to somebody that has been told they've got an autoimmune or a digestive issue, and what would you recommend to someone that is just, there's nothing wrong with them, but they just, like you say, generally maybe just feel a bit rubbish, a bit tired, they want to try paleo. What would you be your recommendations in those cases?
So I have, we initially talked about some potential conditions where I think you should definitely remove all dairy. And a big one is autoimmune disease, celiac disease. There's a lot of sort of cross-reactivity sometimes between antibodies against casein and against gluten and against the gut. And some people who, you know, with something like celiac disease, they'll get flares again if they have casein in the diet. So it might not just be enough to just take gluten out. So anybody with any kind of autoimmunity, cross-reacting antibodies against gluten and casein can potentially affect the thyroid. So I think thyroid disease, particularly autoimmune thyroid disease, all of those diseases, I'd just essentially start by taking them out. Then there's some good evidence to suggest that antibodies the body produces against casein can also bind to certain parts of the brain and cause problems there. So anybody with any kind of neurological disease, particularly multiple sclerosis, most of that work's been done in multiple sclerosis. If you have multiple sclerosis, I'd tell you to take dairy products out of the diet, and I keep them out. I don't think it's ever worth reintroducing them.
I
think you can get your nutrients from other places, and it's not worth the risk. I've seen great benefits from taking gluten and dairy out of the diet, so I just keep it there. Again, beta casomorphin 7 and antibodies against casein might be causing some problems in things like autism and ADHD. And again, casein is a protein that's very high in the amino acid glutamate, and glutamate is a signaling molecule in the brain. I study glutamate quite a lot. And if you have a problem handling glutamate, and glutamate is very high, particularly in soy protein, wheat proteins, and dairy proteins, then maybe taking those, the proteins very high in glutamate out of the diet would be a good thing. So again, you know, autism and ADHD, potentially schizophrenia, where you might be having a problem with glutamate or with beta casomorphin 7, potentially, if you're unable to if you're unable to break it down, I think that might be a potential risk factor there. And then some cancers, I think it's worth just taking out dairy completely. There's a couple of recent studies that show that high-fat dairy is associated with worse breast cancer. And it's the fat component there, and that's because the fat component will contain most of the hormones that come in the milk. And hormone-sensitive cancers tend to be the ones that are specific to a gender. So breast cancer, ovarian cancer, endometrial cancer in women, and prostate cancer in men. So if you have one of those cancers, I just say dairy's not worth it, and I'd take it out. When it comes to prostate cancer in particular, some people say it's the high calcium in dairy. Some people say it's the high phosphate in dairy. There's some evidence that it's the choline. And I lean towards the choline, particularly because choline is used to make testosterone, and testosterone drives these cancers. In fact, a particularly new test for prostate cancer involves an uptake scan for choline. So you inject choline and you watch where it goes. And if it all goes to the prostate, that's a sign that you might have some prostate cancer going on there. Another spanner in the works is that one study shows that it's the fat insoluble choline, so the choline you get from low fat dairy products rather than high fat dairy products. So again, we're not really sure what the mechanism is, but I just take them out, and I think people have had some really good benefits, particularly with prostate and dairy and breast cancer, by just taking dairy out. So all of those people, I'm not really sure dairy is worth it. But for your average person who just wants to get healthier, then I think starting with, you know, a real whole foods diet is the best way to go. And so that's the first thing that you should really do, and just take away all the processed food and all that stuff. And if you want to go, really sort of work your way through these things that might be causing problems, then I'd go for a proper strict paleo, no dairy, no grains. And start there. And, you know, people are a fan of like the month reset or whatever. I think you may benefit from going for a little bit longer, or maybe you wouldn't need quite as long, but that you sort of see what works for you, and then starting to add stuff back. I think kefir, good quality cheeses, good quality butter are all worth including. I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that they're really that bad for us and are probably beneficial for us. And that's both from like a good, healthy, saturated fat content. Grass-fed butter is a high CLA. It's a certain type of fat content which is beneficial for a number of things.
Just to say that I have heard that we hadn't talked about that, but actually the CLA in dairy fat is supposed to be beneficial.
No, absolutely. And the really interesting thing there is that CLA is a naturally occurring trans fat, so we're told that trans fats are only man-made and they're always bad for you. So that's not technically true, because CLA is a trans fat and it's actually very beneficial for you, and is particularly high in grass-fed dairy. So that's what I'd go for those things in particular. I tend to eat, I have a nice grass-fed fermented butter, and I have a lot of kefir, and sometimes I'll have some organic whole fat milk, and I think occasional consumption of those things, if you don't have any issues with them, really won't be that much of a problem. It's sort of what you're looking at is big trends in your diet. So occasional consumption, people really shouldn't worry about that. I don't think, unless they have any of those diseases or have any problems.
But you wouldn't go along the lines of the Western price with the kids drinking loads and loads of raw milk several times a day. You don't think that's a good idea?
It's not necessarily.
I have two kids and I do let them have dairy, because the thing is, kids do like milk.
Yeah. I'm
much more than adults do. Kids actually want to drink a glass of milk, whereas you don't, you kind of tend to do that as an adult. So it's quite hard, because you have these conflicting sources where one kind of, the paleo is going, don't ever have milk. And Western Prize, which I do really, I like all that stuff. They're saying have lots of milk.
I don't really think that we can come up with direct recommendations there. And I think people are going to have to sort of be guided by how they feel about it. If you have access to some really nice, good quality milk, and your kids enjoy it, then I think it's definitely worth it. But I don't think that you need milk. I don't think you need raw milk in particular, if that's what they're saying. I think you can get very healthy, happy babies without it. I'm sure you can. So it's really going to depend on personal preference and how you feel about that. One thing I wanted to quickly mention was, on the grass-fed front, we talk a lot about vitamin K2, particularly from grass-fed dairy, and that being a very good thing, CLA. They've done, I think there are three recent studies that have actually shown, that have compared grass-fed and grain-fed dairy, particularly butter and cream, and they haven't actually found much of a difference between the two in terms of markers of things like inflammation and LDL cholesterol. So in the short term, particularly, grass-fed doesn't seem to have that much of a benefit over grain-fed. But in one particular study I was reading earlier, it's a Danish study, they baked this butter into buns, so you're getting it with a nice big you know, load of wheat and gluten and all that stuff. So it's a So maybe that's a confounding factor there. So again, the grass-fed versus grain-fed is a little bit. We don't have a huge amount of evidence for that. It's largely theoretical. I think if you can get good quality, that's the best thing to go for. And the main thing is just not having so much of it, because I think eating too much of any one thing is always gonna bring problems. So that's kind of where I'd sit.
And if after listening to this, someone decides, right, I'm going to cut dairy out for various different reasons, whether it's that they have got some kind of digestive or autoimmune issues, what's going to happen to their bones? Are they going to crumble away?
Oh, yeah. That's a great question. It comes up a lot. So the modern day calcium recommendations, we're told we need to drink a lot of milk to keep strong bones. And we touched upon it briefly at the beginning. So the modern day calcium recommendations have actually come down recently. They used to be sort of 1 to 2,000 milligrams a day, and now they're down to about 700 milligrams a day in the UK. And that's because we've started to find out there are so many other things that are important in terms of bone health. With osteoporosis in particular, that's the one we talk about a lot. So osteoporosis is actually a disease of the matrix of the bone. So in the bone, you have kind of like all these fibers that come together like this, and then you deposit calcium on those fibers. So in something like rickets or osteomalacia, which are vitamin D deficiency disorders, you get less calcium in the bones, but the matrix is still good. In osteoporosis, what you're actually doing is you're losing the matrix, so you've got less stuff to put calcium on. So you don't need more calcium, you need to build up a better matrix. So it's important to get enough calcium. So leafy green vegetables, you can get tinned fish with bones, that's great. You know, if you can tolerate dairy and you can have some kefir or yogurt or cheese, then that's also good. Some nuts have a good amount of calcium. So you can definitely get it without having dairy. You can get plenty. You can get your 700 milligrams a day.
Bioavailability as well, though, don't you? Because some sources, like spinach, is a really good source of calcium, but we don't absorb it.
No, that's true. And if you're worried about something like that, then if you boil your spinach and then you throw away the water, then you'll get rid of some of the things that bind to the calcium, and you'll maybe absorb it a bit better. So raw spinach or raw kale, which have some calcium. But you probably can't absorb much of it. They probably need to be cooked, and you need to probably throw the cooking water away, and you'll get rid of some of those phytates and oxalates that bind to the calcium. So no, you're absolutely right that we won't absorb all of it. But if you're eating, you know, some nuts, lots of green veggies, like we always talk about, maybe some dairy if you can tolerate it, then I think you'll be getting plenty of calcium.
And there are some other... And if it contains vitamin K2 as well to kind of help with the...
No, absolutely. And part of the reason that we get problems with calcium is because we're not getting enough K2. There's a lot of evidence mounting now that K2, along with vitamin D and vitamin A, are there to kind of signal where your body puts calcium. And so if you look at all the studies that they've done where they've had... older women drink more dairy or take calcium tablets, this calcium doesn't go into their bones, it goes into their arteries and causes heart attacks. And that's not because the calcium is actually bad, it's because they're not getting enough K2 and their body doesn't know what to do with this calcium. So if you're getting your calcium from dairy, from a fermented dairy source with, you know, grass-fed, and you're getting plenty of K2, you don't need very much. You can also get it from, you know, pastured eggs, or even normal eggs. You have 3 or 4 normal eggs in a day and you've probably got enough K2. So you don't need huge amounts, but people are drinking, you know, if they're drinking lots of milk and they're not getting any K2 in their diet, I think that's causing a lot of the problems. And then other things that will reduce your risk of osteoporosis, making sure you get enough vitamin D, particularly from sunshine or from like a fish oil if you can, lots of magnesium, and then getting enough collagen. So like collagen makes the matrix that your calcium goes on in your bones. And we don't eat that much collagen. We that's all the stuff that we cut off the meat, you know, all the joints and gristly bits and stuff. And that's actually really, really important. That's really important. So, you know, that's why everybody's starting to love bone broths, you know, get some amino acids there that you don't really get from eating meat. Some people, you know, can supplement with collagen. or there are some other ways you can get the amino acids there, and actually, dare I say it, beans are a good source of that. But maybe that's a talk for another day. And so plenty of vitamin C, because vitamin C is involved in processing those amino acids. That's why you get scurvy if you don't have vitamin C. So vitamin C, maybe some bone broth so you can get some collagen. And then exercise, weight-bearing exercise, sprinting and lifting weights. And
this is why paleo is a good good template, because by eating a paleo sort of style of diet, you will be getting a lot of nutrients that a lot of people don't get, because there is this focus on bone broths, collagen, all the kind of organ meats, which will be rich sources of all the vitamins that are going to act as sort of cofactors, and an emphasis on doing exercise. So it's kind of bringing all these things together.
Absolutely. And I think that's why just focusing on one nutrient or one mineral will never get you the results that, that people hope. And it was just quickly talking about exercise. They've done, people get scared of lifting weights sometimes, but they've done studies where they've put, 80-year-old women with advanced osteoporosis in the gym and made them, and you lift according to how strong you are. But if you do it with somebody who knows what they're doing and you add more weight, these women saw really impressive improvements in their bone density, more so than you would see if you took a calcium supplement. And then finally, stress is a big one. If you have high levels of cortisol, that's involved in breaking down collagen and things. And that's one of the problems that people get if they have high levels of cortisol, or if they take steroids for a long period of time, they have a lot of problem with their bones, a lot of problems with their joints, because having a high cortisol level can actually break down the collagen, and it does the same to the bones. So reducing stress, by whatever methods you enjoy the most, be it meditation or yoga, or making sure you get enough sleep, or any of those, all of those things together will improve your bone density more than making sure you're drinking however many cups of milk a day.
Brilliant. Okay, well, we've answered all the questions that I had from people, so I think that's a good overview of what we know about dairy.
Yeah, I think so.
And Tommy and I are writing a book at the moment. It's called Eat Better. It will be out probably in January, so keep an eye out for that. You'll be able to read about all this kind of stuff there.
Yeah. And anybody, if we haven't covered a question or you disagree with us, then we absolutely love those kinds of conversations. So you can post it in the comments of wherever you found this, or you can find me at drragnar.com, drragnar.com, or Chloe at paleo-britain.co.uk. And please feel free to sort of let us know what you think.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. Bye.